Hi, and welcome to Lecture 26 of Western Civilization to 1500. I've titled this lecture Official Christianity. I wasn't quite sure what to call this one, but we're going to be exploring in this lecture some important issues that developed in the Christian Church in the 3rd, 4th, and 5th centuries AD, particularly with respect to the question of authority. Who has the proper authority to make decisions in the Christian Church regarding questions of religious doctrine and practice? We saw in an earlier lecture how Christianity expanded pretty rapidly, particularly in the 3rd century. And by the time you get to the point where Constantine makes Christianity legal in the year 313 with the Edict of Milan, we have a diversity of beliefs and practices that are present in churches throughout the Roman Empire. And some of these differences are pretty fundamental, and there start to be, even in some cases, civil unrest as a result of them. And so leaders in the church try to take steps to ensure that there's a unity in the doctrine. And this leads to a number of interesting developments that we'll explore in more detail. Now, early on, one of the major concerns among the Christian churches was, of course, the issue of evangelism. We have missionaries beginning in the first century, the most famous being St. Paul in the book of Acts, with his three missionary journeys, traveling throughout the Mediterranean and establishing congregations of Christians, including in many cases both Jews and Gentiles. And this is the way that Christianity spreads in its early centuries, unlike, for example, Islam, which spread primarily as a result of military conquests. Christianity spreads peacefully within the Roman Empire through a process of persuasion and conversion. And on the graphic on this slide, I've included a map that shows the various stages of the expansion of Christianity. And I know you may not be able to see very closely, but you can see the dark green patches on this map indicate areas that had been, for the most part, Christianized by the year 300. And of course, this is still at the stage when Christianity is illegal. The light green areas represent areas that had been Christianized following Christianity's declaration of toleration in the Edict of Milan, and then it's being made the official religion of the Roman Empire by Theodosius I in the late 4th century. So we see here pretty much the rest of the Roman Empire, as well as some places such as Armenia to the east of the empire. And we'll look at this process of conversion a little more closely in an upcoming lecture. But as the Christian church is growing through these centuries, of course, there are questions of organization and institutional development that inevitably arise. And what church leaders decide to go with, ultimately, following the declaration of toleration for Christianity in the 4th century, is a pattern that largely mirrors the administrative units of the Roman Empire itself as a political body. The Roman Empire had districts called dioceses that were administrative units, each with governors with authority over them, and the church decides that it's going to go with this pattern. So within the Roman Empire, we have dioceses in the church as well, and each diocese is headed by a bishop. Now, as time goes on, there are several of these dioceses that come to be seen as more prestigious, more important than the others. Originally, there are four of these, the Diocese of Jerusalem, the Diocese of Rome, the Diocese of Alexandria in Egypt, and the Diocese of Antioch. All of these locations, all of these cities, play a very important role in the history of the early church. Jerusalem, obviously, as the place where Jesus was crucified and the resurrection took place. The Diocese of Rome, which was the site of, according to church tradition, evangelism by both St. Peter and St. Paul. And then Antioch, it's the place which was the home base for St. Paul during his missionary journeys. We're told in the book of Acts that Antioch is the place where the followers of Jesus were first called Christians. And then finally, Alexandria in Egypt, which does not play an important role in the New Testament itself, but we see very early on a very strong church developing there and intellectual leadership on the part of teachers in Alexandria that have a great influence on the church. So these four dioceses become known as metropolitans, and the leaders, the bishops of these dioceses, are known alternatively as archbishops or as exarchs. Now, later on in the 4th and 5th centuries, we see a fifth diocese being added to this top tier, so to speak, and that's the Diocese of Constantinople, which, as you'll remember from an earlier lecture, is the capital of the Roman Empire following the reign of Constantine. Constantine established a new capital, and we have the Bishop of Constantinople ultimately taking his place among the top rank of bishops in the Roman Empire. This later leads to some conflict, which we'll explore in a few minutes, between the Bishop of Constantinople and the Bishop of Rome. But before we talk about that, I want to look at another important issue that has developed in the early centuries of the church, and that is the issue of heresies. Now, a heresy, in its broadest definition in religious terms, would be any doctrine or teaching that contradicts the doctrine or teaching of the recognized religious authority of that particular group. And we have a number of these heresies developing in the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries in the Christian church. I've listed some of them on this slide, certainly not all of them, just to give you an idea of the diversity of belief that was out there. And in recent years, some scholars have made a great deal of this. You may have heard the name Bart Ehrman from the University of North Carolina. He has labeled these various heresies lost Christianities and tries to present them to the public today as perhaps a more authentic versions of Christianity than what eventually becomes the established doctrine enforced by the religious authorities. Of course, Orthodox Christians and those who align themselves with the historic teachings of the church do not see these as more authentic versions of Christianity. They see them as errors and heresies. But we have here just a few of these. Docetism, a heresy that flourished in the first century, which asserted that Jesus Christ had no physical body. And so whenever we read in the Gospels, for example, of the physical suffering, the passion and crucifixion of Christ, we're reading something metaphorical because they did not believe that Christ had a physical body to be punished by the political authorities. Docetism and several of these other heresies as well, you can see how some of these people are trying to reconcile inherited ideas from various Greek philosophies, particularly Platonism, which really downplays the significance of the material world and the teachings of the New Testament. And many of these people were not able to reconcile in their minds the idea, for example, that Christ could have a physical body if they thought that the physical world is inferior or corrupt, and the idea that God would become incarnate in human flesh was beyond what they could accept. So we have a number of these heresies arising out of that tension. Gnosticism is another example of this. The Gnostics believed that the material world was corrupt, and that each human being was mainly corrupt because of our physical nature, but that each of us also has what they called sparks of divinity within us. And by the acquisition of some secret knowledge, or gnosis in the Greek, you could unlock this more divine nature and ascend at your death beyond the physical and into the spiritual plane. So the Gnostics become pretty influential in certain parts of the church in the second century, and we have today a lot of attention given to the so-called Gnostic Gospels. They have titles like the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Philip, which are purportedly by certain of Jesus' apostles, but they are second century documents. They don't come from the earliest days of the Christian church. And the church ultimately rejected these documents as forgeries and not containing the true teachings of Christ. The Gnostics have, as I said, a great deal of influence in certain areas. And one of the early creeds of the church, which we'll see in a minute, is directed mainly against the Gnostics. Then we have the Marcionites, which I mentioned briefly in an earlier lecture. The Marcionites believed that the Bible speaks of two different gods. The God of the Old Testament and the God of the New Testament are separate entities. The God of the Old Testament is evil and concerned with the physical, whereas the God of the New Testament is good and concerned with the spiritual. So the Marcionites they saw a radical break between the Old and New Testaments. And we saw in the earlier lecture how one of the fathers of the early church, Polycarp, strenuously argued against the Marcionites. Donatism is a heresy that flourished in the 3rd and 4th centuries, primarily in North Africa, which was a place where Christianity was very successful in its spread. Donatists formulated their beliefs primarily in response to some of the very fierce persecutions that took place in the 3rd century under the emperors Decius and Diocletian. In some of these persecutions, you had leaders in the church, priests, ministers, who actually recanted their Christianity under the threat of persecution. Then, once the persecution had receded, some of these men attempted to resume their positions of authority within the church. And the Donatists were very upset by this, and they formulated the position that no sacrament, for example, no rite of baptism, no rite of serving the Holy Communion or the Eucharist, that was performed by one of these priests who had lapsed in his faith during persecution. No rite performed by one of these men was valid. And you can see some of the implications of this idea. This would, if taken to its logical conclusion, would mean that no Christian could ever be completely confident that the ceremonies that had been performed, either to initiate him into the church through baptism or the ongoing ceremony of communion, which he took part in regularly, no Christian could ever be 100% certain that he was participating in valid ceremonies because he could not really know the full extent of the history of the minister or priest who was administering these rites to him. And so this became a very contentious issue, and many churches divided over this, and it became, in some areas, even a cause for riots and civil unrest. And then finally, we have Arianism. This Arianism has nothing to do with the idea of the Aryans, but that the Nazis talked about, an ethnic group in the 20th century. This heresy has to do with the teachings of a certain church leader named Arius, who taught that Jesus Christ was a created being. Now, this is a very important idea that the church is working on in its early centuries, the development of the doctrine of the Trinity, and trying to understand the language of the Gospels and the epistles of the New Testament, explaining who exactly Jesus is and what his nature is, how his human nature interacts with his divine nature, and what his relationship is to God the Father. Now, Arius could not reconcile the notion that Christ was truly God. The idea of the Son of God, he could accept that, but the idea that Christ was God himself, he could not accept. And so we have this doctrine formulated by Arius, which was in contradiction to what had been the mainstream understanding of the nature of Jesus through much of the church in the first, second, and third centuries, that Jesus was a created being. He was the firstborn of all creation in the language of the Gospels, but he was not God himself, or of the same nature, of the same substance as God, that he was more like an archangel or a super angel, if you will, that God created Jesus first, and then through Jesus created the rest of the universe, the rest of creation. Well, again, this is a very divisive idea. For someone outside the church, it might be seem just a curiosity or a strange kind of thing that people would argue over this. But along with the general attempts at philosophical rigor in the classical world, we also have a very practical question that arises here. How can the atonement work? How can God reconcile humanity to himself fully if God's nature demands a separation from sin, yet we do not have God himself making a sacrifice in order to bring about that reconciliation? And so the opponents of Arianism would allege that if Jesus is not truly God, then the Christian faith is vain. You cannot have an angel sacrificing himself for humanity and accomplishing that reconciliation with God. In other words, the atonement is a God-sized task, and nothing short of God sacrificing himself would bring that about. So we have a lot of churches dividing over this question as well. And by the time we get to the early 4th century, in particular, the Donatist and Arian heresies are causing a lot of trouble throughout the empire in areas where Christianity has taken root. Now, the church dealt with these heresies in several different ways in the early centuries. We have the formulation at various points in the history of the church, certain creeds or statements of faith, which were intended to separate those who had an orthodox belief in the minds of the leaders of the church from those who were embracing one of these deviant ideas or something that was incorrect in their view. And one of the earliest of these creeds that church leaders formulated is known colloquially as the Apostles' Creed. Not because one of the apostles actually promulgated the words of this creed, but that it was viewed by church leaders as accurately expressing the teachings of the apostles of the first century. And the earliest forms of this creed probably date from the second century, so it takes root pretty early. And the Apostles' Creed is most specifically directed against the Gnostics. We have language in the creed which specifically says several things about Jesus and his physical nature, the affirmation of the virgin birth, and that Jesus really did suffer in the flesh, for example. The Gnostics had a disadvantage in arguing against some of these leaders, the bishops in the church, and this is a very important point in the formulation of the ideas of authority in the early church. The leaders of important dioceses, such as the Diocese of Rome, who argued against the Gnostics, could point to their own heritage, so to speak. And these guys were just a few generations removed from the apostles. In some cases, such as in the case of Polycarp, had actually known some of the apostles personally. And so they were in a strong position to say to the Gnostics, look, we knew the apostles, or we knew men who knew the apostles, and if the apostles had really been trying to promulgate some idea of gnosis, or secret knowledge that enables us to transcend the physical, we would have known that. That message would have come to us through them, but they never told us anything like that. And so you Gnostics are getting this from some other source, and this is an error, a theological error that we must condemn. And by the end of the second century, in many cases, the bishops had been successful in persuading the overwhelming majority of Christians that the Gnostic teachings were incorrect. Now, Gnosticism in various forms continues to come back to affect the church at different stages in the church history. And we'll see that in later lectures. But once we have the official recognition of Christianity as a legal religion after the Edict of Milan in 313, leaders of the church decided to take a different route towards addressing some of these heresies. And the idea of a general council came into being. This is the notion that all the bishops, or as many bishops as they could gather from all parts of the empire, could meet together in one place and have a thorough discussion over some of these theological issues and come to a consensus over what was the true teaching, what was the intent of Christ and the apostles for the church, and what should be condemned as a heresy. Now, Constantine actually calls the first of these what are called ecumenical councils in the year 325. It met in a city in Asia Minor called Nicaea, which is not that far from the new capital of Constantinople. And we had more than 300 bishops attend the Council of Nicaea. Constantine was eager to have a meeting like this of the church leaders because of some of the civil unrest that had resulted from divisions in the church over the Donatist heresy or the Arian heresy. There's all kinds of practical legal consequences and issues that have to be dealt with. For example, when a church splits, who gets the property? If the church owns some land or a building or something of that sort, I mean, those are questions that the law has to address. And so what Constantine is interested in here, although he's not a theologian himself, he at this point believes the basic teachings of Christianity, but he does not have any kind of deep understanding of Christian theology. What he wants is for the bishops to tell him what is the correct theological position on some of these thorny issues that are having a political impact, and then he'll go out and he will enforce legally what the bishops tell him is the correct position. So if you have a church split, in the example I just mentioned, you would have Constantine and the law favoring the Orthodox party over the heretical party in those kinds of legal disputes. So after much debate, we have, with only two dissenting votes, the bishops agree that they will condemn Arianism and Donatism as heresies. And we have a new creed that comes out of the Council of Nicaea, and it's known in church history as the Nicene Creed. Churches all over the world in their assemblies will recite the Nicene Creed during their periods of worship. We have language in the creed that has some very specific wording concerning the nature of Jesus, the Greek word homoousios, which means that Jesus is of the same substance or the same nature as the Father. It is placed into the Nicene Creed as a way of identifying Arian heretics, anyone who's not willing to say these words as part of their profession of faith would be considered a suspect theologically by local church leaders. We have a number of other ecumenical councils that take place in the succeeding centuries. Most church historians will say that altogether there are seven ecumenical councils. The Nicene Council is the first, and the last takes place in the 8th century. Another important development in the early centuries of the Christian Church is the assertion of authority on the part of the Bishop of Rome, who also comes to be known as the Pope. Now, we have, again, an association that with the city of Rome. It's a very important place, not only because it's the capital, but also because the apostles seem to attach a particular importance to it. St. Peter, for example, according to church tradition, went to Rome and was one of its early leaders, one of the church's early leaders in Rome. St. Paul also made it a priority to visit Rome and, according to church tradition, was martyred there. So we have developing in the tradition and theology of the Christian Church the notion that the Bishop of Rome has a particular authority that other bishops do not have. And the bishops of Rome rested their case to a great extent on what came to be known as the doctrine of Petrine supremacy. This idea was based on a passage in the Gospels, the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 16, in which Jesus, following his transfiguration, had a group of the apostles around him and asked them, who do men say that I am? And the apostles say various things. Some say that you're Elijah, some say that you're John the Baptist. Jesus then asks them, well, who do you say that I am? And Peter replies, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Jesus says then to Peter, blessed are you because flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who's in heaven. And then Jesus goes on to say, I say to you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church. Well, the name Peter in Latin means stone or rock. And so we have the idea developing here very early on that Peter is given a sort of special status among the apostles, that he is the rock upon which the Christian church is to be built. The bishops of Rome argued that because Peter came to Rome and was a leader of the church there, according to church tradition, and that Peter was martyred in Rome, that Peter then passed this special status as the leader of the church or the rock on which the church is built onto his successors as leaders of the church at Rome. And so by the time we get to the 4th century or so, we have the bishops of Rome making explicit claims in writing to other bishops that because they are in this line of succession from Peter, to whom Jesus gave this special authority, that they too had a particular authority that other bishops should recognize and defer to them. One of the early examples of this we have is Pope Damasus in the 4th century, who, in his writings to other bishops, addressed them not as brothers, which was the traditional way in which Christians and bishops addressed each other, but as sons, indicating that he had a particular kind of authority over them. Now, the first really explicit claims of papal authority arise as a result of conflict over doctrinal questions in which the Bishop of Rome and the Bishop of Constantinople take opposing sides. Now, again, I know there are differences on this question between among practicing Catholics, Protestants, and Orthodox Christians. I'm not necessarily saying here that these ideas were not present earlier in church history, but this is the first time that we see really strong statements of them. The Bishop of Constantinople was trying to assert his own authority in the church on the basis of the fact that he was the bishop in the capital city of the empire. Well, the Bishop of Rome formulates a counter-argument to this, and the bishop who's credited with formulating the what comes to be the most definitive statement of the doctrine of Petrine supremacy is Pope Leo I in the mid-5th century. To give you an idea of Leo's importance, there are only two popes in church history who are given the moniker the Great, and Leo I is one of them. So he's known in church history as Leo the Great, and we have during his pontificate a very important ecumenical council taking place at the city of Chalcedon or Chalcedon. I've heard it pronounced both ways. People argue over the pronunciation of this term, but we'll go with Chalcedon. We have an argument over defining the nature of Jesus. Now, the Bishop of Constantinople and the Bishop of Rome are taking different positions on this, and I won't go into all the particulars of the doctrine, but the Bishop of Constantinople is arguing, I'm the bishop of the capital city. I have this authority to make this decision, and people should follow my lead. Leo, on the contrary, says, the fact that you're the bishop of the capital city has nothing to do with whether you have authority in the church or not. Now, it's true that for hundreds of years, we bishops of Rome were bishops of the capital city and we exercised this authority, but that's not the basis of our authority. The basis of our authority is that Jesus gave this special recognition and authority to St. Peter, and we are successors of St. Peter as bishops of Rome. That is where our authority comes from. So it's a spiritual authority, not an authority that derives from the political status of the city where the bishop is. Now, ever since this time, the bishops of Rome have continued to assert this position. And of course, today, Roman Catholics acknowledge the Pope as the only true leader of the church. On earth, always, of course, being subject to Christ himself. But this position takes root firmly, at least in theory, in the West. And we see throughout the Middle Ages, as we'll see in later lectures, popes continuing to assert this authority. And we ultimately have very substantial legal, political, social consequences of this doctrine. Well, just one or two more statements about the question of church and state before we end this lecture. Once Christianity becomes a tolerated religion and then the official religion of the empire, this immediately raises all sorts of issues about what the appropriate relationship between the government of the empire and the leadership of the church is. We have many emperors who take the position that they should have some role of authority in the church. Now, this is not an unusual position for political rulers in the ancient world to take. We've seen how in most of these other civilizations we've examined, that political leaders do occupy some religious office as well. And the Caesars in Roman history had always held the office of Pontifex Maximus, high priest. So once Theodosius makes Christianity the official religion, he assumes that, well, I get to be the leader of the church. Now, the bishops want to dispute this, of course. They say, look, I know our authority as bishops doesn't come from the political validation of our position. We have authority that comes directly from Christ and the apostles. That's where authority in the church comes from. It has nothing to do with who the emperor is. So there's an argument brewing over that. We also have a growing issue of bishops taking a part in the government. The bishops are widely respected and trusted people in most of the cities, and it's natural for the emperors and other political figures to turn to them for assistance in public administration. And so we see bishops taking on roles in the Roman government very frequently. Now, this leads to all kinds of issues. Does the bishop now have divided loyalties? Is he trying to serve two masters, in the biblical language, by trying to be a political figure and also a spiritual leader at the same time? And this is an issue that the church wrestles with for many centuries. To give you a couple of specific examples of how the church tried to deal with this issue, basically what's happening for the most part is that the church is struggling to maintain its independence. I know that we hear all the time today about how people raise the specter of, oh, the church is going to take on this political role and we're going to be living in a theocracy and so on, and the church is going to persecute everybody. I mean, historically, that has not been the way in which the relationship between the church and the state has worked, with very isolated exceptions. The main story of Western civilization is political leaders trying to exercise authority in the church and church leaders trying to maintain their independence and try to stay free of those secular authorities. We have a very early example of this with the Emperor Theodosius and Saint Ambrose. Ambrose was the Bishop of Milan, and during his tenure as bishop, Theodosius returns from a victorious military campaign in the East. Theodosius had committed a number of atrocities on this campaign, and Ambrose knew of this. When Theodosius came to Milan, he went to the cathedral in Milan and wanted to take communion. Ambrose refused to administer communion to him. This made Theodosius very angry. He said, "I'm the emperor. You're my subject. You have to do what I say. I'm telling you to serve me communion." And Ambrose says, "Well, yes, I am your subject in all things worldly, but in spiritual matters, I'm the authority here, and you have to listen to me. And I'm telling you that you've sinned greatly in committing these atrocities. You must repent and do penance before I serve communion to you." And in this instance, Theodosius actually backed down. The public apparently was on Ambrose's side, and Theodosius relented. He did do public penance for these atrocities he had committed, and then Ambrose restored him to fellowship. So we see there an early victory of the church in church-state relations and trying to maintain its own independence and saying that in spiritual matters, the bishops are the supreme authority. We see this idea laid out in a little more systematic way in the late 5th century by a pope named Gelasius I. Gelasius formulated what's known as the two swords theory of authority. And this goes back to the Gospel of Matthew, excuse me, the Gospel of Luke, when Jesus is at the Last Supper with his apostles. There's an interesting conversation where Jesus is telling the apostles, "I'm sending you out now into the world. I won't be with you. I told you when I sent you out earlier that you wouldn't need a sword, but now I'm telling you, you're going to need a sword. You're going to need to defend yourselves." And the apostles say, "See, Lord, we have two swords here." And Jesus says, "That's enough." It's a very curious passage, but Gelasius allegorizes this verse out of Luke and says, what Jesus is really speaking of here with these two swords is that in the world there are two forms of authority. There is a secular, or worldly, or temporal authority, and then there is a spiritual authority. And God has given these two authorities to different institutions. He's given the sword of temporal authority to the emperor and the sword of spiritual authority to the pope. Now, these are by and large separate spheres of authority. 99% of the time, the temporal authority and the spiritual authority should not overlap. They shouldn't conflict in any way. The church lays out spiritual forms of discipline. When people sin, the emperor metes out temporal or physical punishment to people who have broken temporal laws. But Gelasius says, in the rare case when there is some overlap and you have a potential for the temporal sword operating within its appropriate sphere to conflict with the spiritual sword operating within its appropriate sphere, then in those very rare cases, the spiritual sword, the Pope, takes precedence because, of course, we all know that spiritual things are more important than earthly things. So we have an early expression here of this idea of when push comes to shove, if necessary, the spiritual authority is supreme. And popes continue to rely on this language of the two swords for many hundreds of years. The idea receives different treatment in the Middle Ages, and eventually we get to a point where popes are making much more grand claims for their own authority by the time we get to the 13th and 14th centuries, for example. We'll examine that in a future lecture. But for now, we're seeing some of the very early conflict between church and state and how the church is trying to maintain its independence. In this lecture, we've looked at a number of important issues regarding authority in the early church, questions of heresy and who has the proper authority to make decisions about doctrine and practice in the church, and also issues of what role the government has to play in the church and vice versa. In the next lecture, we'll continue our discussion of the early church, focusing on several important writers called the early church fathers. Thanks for watching.